From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We are the generation who was born and came of adult age during the most toxic and environmentally unregulated decade ever known, whose baby food was contaminated with traces of DDT, PCBs, and DES.
Breast cancer survivors look for the causes of their illness. The U.S. Southern Command leaves Panama for Miami, and Saturday is a national day of conscience to end child labor and sweatshop abuses. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today the Democratic National Committee quietly transferred at least $32 million to state Democratic parties in the last election as part of an elaborate plan to spend more money than federal election law appeared to allow on a huge advertising campaign that indirectly helped reelect President Clinton. The plan was conceived and coordinated by the Clinton-Gore campaign staff and Democratic Party officials as an end run around legal spending limits. This according to documents and interviews with Democratic officials. The Clinton campaign had agreed to the limits in return for accepting millions of dollars in public financing. Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo made an unprecedented visit to the troubled area of Mexico's far south yesterday, seeking to revive stalled efforts to end the region's rebel conflict. It was the first visit by a Mexican head of state to the Los Altos Mountains of southernmost Chiapas state in 15 years. Zedillo came close to areas that Zapatista rebels say are under their control. His visit appears to be a response to an equally unprecedented journey just a few weeks ago by mass Zapatista rebel representatives to Mexico City. In that trip, Indian rebel leaders angrily demanded Zedillo honor agreements and previous peace accords and pull the army out of Chiapas. If not, they challenged him to wage full-scale war against them. In his speech, Zedillo made no reference to the Zapatista visit, nor to almost 18 months of peace talks that broke down a year ago amid rebel accusations that the government reneged on a peace accord on Indian rights. Ron Carey's former campaign manager has told federal investigators that the Teamsters president was aware of a scheme to funnel union treasury money into his campaign coffers. This according to sources close to the investigation. Carey denies the reported assertion. Carey testified yesterday before a federal grand jury investigating his 1996 reelection campaign. Emerging from the hearing room, he declined to discuss his testimony, but he did deny his former aide's statement. Executions in the United States are at a four-decade high and rising. The latest execution took place last night. A convicted murderer in Texas became the 57th prisoner to be put to death this year. That's the largest number since 1957, when 65 people were executed nationwide. The Death Penalty Information Center says death row stays are going to become shorter as state and federal governments streamline the appeals process. Texas leads the nation with 6 executions. Virginia ranks second. A study finds the quality of HMOs varies widely across the country when it comes to such things as screening for breast cancer, treating heart disease, and immunizing children. The National Committee for Quality Assurance, which accredits HMOs, has released its annual survey. It says tens of thousands of lives would be saved if every HMO performed as well as the best do. For instance, some health plans screen 90% of women at risk for breast cancer in 96, others screens just 30%. Paula Jones has new lawyers who made it clear they're prepared to take President Clinton to court over sex harassment allegations, and a conservative group will pay the bill. The Dallas law firm of Rader, Campbell, Fisher & Pike has taken her case. This according to Mrs. Jones, who made the announcement yesterday through her spokesperson. Paula Jones says the Rutherford Institute of Charlottesville, Virginia, will raise money to pay for legal representation. Hazy smog from Indonesian forest fires hung thickly over Singapore all day today, causing the government to warn people to avoid rigorous outdoor activities. Visibility was limited to about 1 mile, with skyscrapers on the Singapore skyline disappearing into the whitish-gray haze. Hundreds of fires, many of them deliberately lighted to clear land for plantations, have been burning in forests and scrublands across Indonesia for weeks, producing a thick haze that has drifted over neighboring Malaysia, Thailand, the Philippines, Brunei, as well as Singapore. The United States gave the keys of Albrook Air Force Base to Panama yesterday, part of a commitment to withdraw all troops and hand over all U.S. installations in the country by the end of the century. At a ceremony watched by some 200 demonstrators waving Panamanian flags and shouting, "Yankees go home and long live Panama," soldiers lowered the U.S. flag for the last time at Albrook, ending over 80 years of U.S. military presence. And we'll have more on that story later in the show. Fast-track trade legislation passed the Senate Finance Panel in what the White House hopes will be a boost for the troubled proposal. In a compromise to win bipartisan support, references to labor and environmental rights would be largely advisory, and programs to aid workers hurt by imports would continue. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with my co-host Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Good day, Amy.
Well, yesterday was a very big day in Puerto Rico.
Yes, there was a general strike across the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico in protest over the attempts by the government of Puerto Rico to privatize the Puerto Rico Telephone Company. The Puerto Rico Telephone Company is the equivalent in Puerto Rico of what the Mexican the oil industry is in Mexico. It's the national pride. It's one of the best run corporations in the country. Any public telephone phone is still 10 cents when you want to make a call. Service is excellent, but the telecommunications bill that was passed a couple of years back has now ended the monopoly that the phone company has for local phone service, and the Puerto Rican government has decided to sell the company, even though it produces about $1.1 billion a year in income to the government. And this has outraged many people throughout the island. Labor organizations, environmental groups, religious groups all united, and the island was virtually shut down in a general strike protesting the government's plan. We don't know how it's going to turn out, but the idea that in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, a territory, a colony of the United States, a successful general strike was effectuated is unprecedented.
Was this the largest strike in Puerto Rico?
Yes, there have been attempts at general strikes in the past, but from all accounts, this was the most successful one. And between 100 and 150,000 people marched to the Capitol to protest the sale.
This is particularly significant as we move into 1998, the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the U.S. occupation.
Right. Next year will be the 100th anniversary of the largest and most profitable colony the United States has ever had.
Well, speaking about profits, Juan, in the wake of last spring's sweatshop summit of garment industry leaders, trade unions, and government officials at the White House, labor and human rights activists are now pushing the giant multinationals and the Clinton administration to stick to their promises to eliminate sweatshop abuses. On Saturday, thousands of people across North America will be participating in events to demand an end to U.S. companies' ties to sweatshops and child labor. It's the National Labor Committee, which has brought together a broad-based coalition of over 100 religious, labor, human rights, students, women's, and grassroots organizations who will be sponsoring the activities around the country. We're joined right now by Charlie Kernaghan, who is director of the National Labor Committee, a labor research and advocacy group based in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now, Charlie.
Thank you.
So tell us about this event on Saturday, which is actually launching a broader season of conscience.
That's right. Saturday, the National Day of Conscience, is really just a launch date for three solid months of pressure on the corporations. We're going to move right into the holiday season of conscience. We're asking people to shop with their conscience. We're going to push companies in the right direction. We'll reward companies which are moving in the right direction, and let's punish companies which continue to undermine human rights and use child labor. Along the way, we're going to gather 1 million signatures on a petition to the Congress and to the President of the United States saying enough. We don't want child labor. We don't want sweatshops. We want to have corporations be held accountable for human rights. We want corporations to pay a living wage. And we want corporations to stop this practice of stripping workers of their rights, firing them and blacklisting them when they try to meet, when they try to organize, when they try to learn their rights. So it's actually going amazingly well. I'd say for Saturday, What we know of, and we're not in control of this thing at all, I'm glad to say it's out of control. It's cropping up everywhere. In fact, it's not even national any longer. The Canadian Labour Congress yesterday endorsed the campaign. The Catholic Church in Canada endorsed the campaign. The Jesuit Center endorsed the campaign. They will be doing a press conference today. They will be remaking the petition so it's equivalent to, for Canada. In France and in Belgium, we've heard that they've handed out 40,000 brochures on the Day of Conscience. So this thing is out there now. It's even beyond the United States. But right here, we're up to about 35 cities and dozens of communities and college campuses across the country. And that's just what we know. New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Detroit, Portland, Oregon, Freeport, Maine, Burlington, Vermont, Louisville, Kentucky, Baltimore, outside of Washington, D.C., Pentagon, the Pentagon Mall. It's really... catching on.
Yesterday, you held a big news conference in Washington, D.C. with John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO. What happened there?
Well, the first thing that surprised me was when I went into the building, no one threw a net over me. Like, in the old days, I wouldn't dare go even on the same block with the building there at the AFL-CIO headquarters in Washington. So you do sense a change. President Sweeney was very warm towards the work, came over immediately and said, you know, this is the direction we want to start going in. And said very good things about the campaign, and for the first time, they're actually now, I think they're going to open a lot of the unions to this work. He sent out a personal letter to all the AFL-CIO presidents, the central labor councils in each city, and the state feds, and said support this thing. Now, it's a little late, you know, obviously for October 4th, but as we go towards the holiday season of conscience, they could play a major role. We're seeing things happening now that never, ever happened in the past. For example, the American Federation of Teachers has endorsed the campaign. They've sent our material out to teachers across the country, and they encourage these teachers to include our material in their curriculums. So all of a sudden, like, say, in New York State, we're getting phone calls from the 375,000 teachers all across the state asking for material so that they can begin to incorporate that into their classes. Now, you know, this is, like, unheard of in the past. The United Auto Workers, they're going to put two full pages on this campaign in their national magazine, which goes out to 1.4 million workers. The machinists are going to do the same thing. So in many ways for us, I mean, if you're a small human rights group or a religious group, and you're looking at a different AFL-CIO now. I mean, a lot more needs to be done. But so it was a pretty, for me, it was very interesting. But I did keep my eyes open, make sure.
And Charlie, in terms of the impact of the campaign on corporate America, do you see fault lines developing now in terms of companies that are responding to the pressure versus others that are digging in and resisting?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting developments is the fact that under the White House task force to eliminate sweatshop abuses, a few companies have sort of broken with the industry. And it's not that they're doing any great things. I mean, we're not going to get down on our knees and start applauding here. But they are at a table, and they're at a table, and they're discussing human rights. They're discussing a living wage. They're discussing opening these factories to independent monitoring by local religious and human rights organizations. And for the first time, they're discussing setting an industry-wide standard with some enforcement and some oversight. So I think a little split has been made, and that's very important because on the other side, you know, you have the Walmarts, you have the May companies, you have the Guess, the Disneys. You have these companies which are doing everything possible to undermine this task force. So it's, I think, a very interesting opportunity. We decided, despite the fact that the task force is not moving fast enough, despite the fact that its initial accord was way short of what the people in this country want, that it was better not to sit on the sidelines. It was better to jump in. And one of the reasons for October 4th is to push that task force in the right direction. They think they're going to go behind closed doors, the companies, you know, with a few groups that the Clinton administration picked to sit behind closed doors. That's fine. I mean, no one ever invites us behind these doors anyway. We're glad not to go back there. But what we want to do is bring the public into this debate. And that's one of the things October 4th is about. So one of the goals of this National Day of Conscience is to push the White House, push the Congress, as we push the companies. And frankly, the people can do it.
We're talking to Charlie Kernaghan, director of the National Labor Committee, Labor Research and Advocacy Group. If you've never heard of him before, his is the group, and he's the person who led the campaign against the GAF, bringing up young women from Central America talking about the GAP's activities there until an agreement was reached between human rights groups and the GAP. Then he took on Kathy Lee Gifford and her clothing line that was sold at Walmart. And now, apparently, Charlie, Kathy Lee Gifford is writing a part of the Smithsonian exhibition on sweatshops. We'll see whether or not this exhibition actually takes place. Just a few days ago, we had a debate on the subject because the Apparel Manufacturers Association, as well as some Congress members, are leading a charge to prevent it from going up with a focus on sweatshops.
Well, it has to be expected. The industry cannot defend its practices. They can't defend the 13-cent wages in China, the 6-cent wages in Burma. They can't defend the 31-cent wages in Honduras. They can't defend children, 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds working 20-hour shifts, 16-hour shifts on the armed guard. And they can't defend the growth of sweatshops in the United States.
What do you make of the legislation that was just being dealt with yesterday in Congress around indentured kids whose parents sell them into slavery and then they have to work, you know, for 10 years to get out of it and make rugs, for example, in places like Pakistan?
I think it's a very significant first step. I mean, it's so pathetic in some ways that we have to applaud a legislation that bars products made by slave a child labor entering the country. But still, given that this is the Congress it is, given what we're up against, this is a real important first step, and it proves that we can take on the companies like that. I think it's very significant. We should take our hats off to Congressman Sanders and Senator Harkin on this one.
Well, by the way, Bernie Sanders, the congressman from Vermont, will be joining us tomorrow on Democracy Now!
A number of the companies have launched new public relations offensives in light of all this criticism. For instance, I'm getting communication from many Hispanic organizations around the country that are suddenly getting infusions of support from Nike. What do you make of this new offensive by the companies? Obviously, Nike attempted the Andy Young end-around tactic a few months back. What do you make of these offensives on their part?
Well, I think that the companies are nervous. I'm very nervous, and it's the companies are aware of the fact that, say, campaigns like this are not going to hurt them economically. I mean, it's not at the point where we're going to damage these multinationals economically. However, they are afraid that this kind of work is going to get out of control. They're afraid that it is spreading into the schools, which it is, and it is spreading into the religious community, which it is, and it is spreading into the labor community. They're quite nervous over how this thing is going to work out over the next couple of years. So, of course, their first reaction is to throw money at it. I mean, that's just typical. And Nike, with its $650 million a year in advertising, how dare these grassroots people come up against us? You know, how dare these workers in Vietnam or Indonesia challenge us? So they're going to go down fighting. I mean, one of the things we're doing is we're going to come up with a list of the worst companies, and we're going to release that list the day after Thanksgiving, the busiest shopping day of the year. And I understand from what I'm hearing is that companies don't want to be on that list. You know, I don't think Nike wants to be on that list, but they very well might be, you know. And it's I just see this as the first step, and it's going places, and the companies are nervous. And what you're saying, I think, is a good indication that they're nervous.
We're talking to Charlie Kernaghan, director of the National Labor Committee. On Saturday, they will be launching a National Day of Conscience into a holiday season of conscience. This press conference that you'll be holding the day after Thanksgiving, the busiest shopping day of the year, do you have, what is it going to be, a list of 10?
Well, at first I said a 30, but then I decided let's just make this a list in progress. And we're dealing right now with religious organizations, with the unions. We're sitting down with grassroots groups together in a coalition. We're going to make up this list,
Charlie,
and release it.
What about the whole issue of what's going on in the unions right now? We just heard about Ron Carey testifying yesterday around the whole Teamsters campaign finance scandal, and this may go right up into the AFL-CIO with Richard Trumka, the Secretary General. Does this have any effect on the kind of organizing you're doing and this increased awareness about sweatshops?
Well, the timing is unfortunate. Thank God we're out of that beltway in Washington. I mean, we don't even follow it too closely. What we're finding, I mean, I just got back from the Manitoba Labor Federation, of all places, and the response of 650 delegates was to take on this campaign, and the enthusiasm was, like, unbelievable. They want to take it back to schools, to congregations. to their local unions. Every day we're being swamped. Yesterday we got a call from a CWA local in California.
Communication Workers of America.
They want 6,000 petitions in Spanish for their members and things like this. I mean, it's the response to this stuff has been overwhelming.
Charlie Kernighan, we have to break. We're going to come back with you. And then after that, we're going to go down to Panama to hear about what's happening as a result of the U.S. Southern Command moving to Miami. And finally, yes, this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, October is. And this month on HBO, there's going to be a documentary that runs a number of times about breast cancer survivors searching for causes of their illness. And we'll talk with one of those survivors, who's the producer of the documentary called Rachel's Daughters. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up our discussion with Charlie Kernighan, who is director of the National Labor Committee, which is launching, along with a coalition of other groups around the country, a National Day of Conscience on Saturday, which will lead into the holiday months, the holiday season of conscience to end child labor and sweatshop abuses.
Charlie, you were recently in Mexico touring some of the maquilas. What's the latest update on what you were able to see there?
Well, enormous misery. It was my first trip to Mexico. I was blown out of the water. We saw big companies like Alcoa and GE referring to the workers as associates. There are no workers, evidently, in Mexico. They're all associates. And we decided to visit the associates' homes, and we found out that they were being paid 54 cents an hour. We went to Alcoa Associates. You know, Alcoa made $637 million last year profit. And then the second quarter of 1997, their profits were up 57%. So it was a shock to go to an associate's house and see it, a house made of cardboard. They took the shipping crates, the pallets, the wood, where the material sent down, assembled it, tacked up some cardboard to it, and that's how these people were living, working for Alcoa.
And what cities along the border did you visit?
This was right below San Antonio, Texas, Acuna and Pedro Negras. Mm-hmm. Alcoa has 9,000 workers in that one city of Acuna. GE, the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, $7.28 billion of profit last year, was paying, we talked to single mothers, working 6 to 8 hours at night shift. Big bags under their eyes, working 6 to 8 hours, 4:15 in the evening to 6 a.m. They took home for that $49.22, 72 cents an hour, and it's criminal.
I remember several years back when I was in Reynosa, there, Zenith alone had 10, 12 factories in the city of Reynosa, manufacturing all kinds of components for television sets, and the same type of wage conditions and throughout the Maquila section of the border.
It's booming now. Factories are going up everywhere, wanted signs. I mean, it's really booming, and the workers tell us their wages are going down. Their ability to survive is very precarious. We didn't speak to a single worker who could afford to buy meat or chicken or milk or vegetables or fruit or cereal. People are really suffering, and also they're stripped of their rights. I mean, there's no abilities there to organize or to even meet.
Charlie Kernighan, can you give us the phone number that people can call if they're interested in the National Day of Conscience on Saturday and the National Season of Conscience?
Sure. We can send out all sorts of material. We can put people in contact with local groups. We can send out posters, the whole works. If they call us at 212 area code 242-3002. It's in New York. It's the National Labor Committee office. We're going to be there all night. We'll send stuff out all across the country for Saturday and beyond.
I would think that you could get some donations from some of the celebrities that get funded, for example, by Nike, you know, to the tune of $20 million a year, because after all, it's groups like yours and Global Exchange that probably is getting them all that money, because every time Nike gets a big hit in the papers and the press, they have to buy off another celebrity to make them look good.
You hit a soft point, because I'm actually frightened now to go anywhere, like say to a big foundation and to apply for money, because we never get it, but then they turn around and fund people to study us, or they fund a business group. So, like, I'm paranoid if I go to the Ford Foundation, I'm going to get grants for everybody else. And so you're touching it. Obviously, we always struggle funding-wise, because the companies, if they do anything, they hire detectives to follow us around, so they're not funding us. We're funding detective agencies, and yeah, it's a problem.
Well, thank you very much to this person who causes trouble around the world, Charlie Kernaghan, the executive director of the National Labor Committee based in New York City. After this short musical break with Harry Belafonte singing about dangerous times, we're going to go down to Panama and talk about the U.S. Southern Command and what does it mean for that country and for all of Latin America that it's left and is headed to Miami.
Afraid to hold on, afraid to let go, afraid to find out, but afraid not to know, afraid of what's broken, but still doesn't show. These are dangerous times. Afraid of the sky, afraid of the light, afraid of the wind that will carry the night, afraid of bad news from the satellite. These are dangerous times to love. Do not stand up together. We can find no solid ground.
Harry Belafonte singing the song Dangerous Times from a new CD, An Evening with Harry Belafonte and Friends. Well, to the cries of Yankee go home, the United States yesterday formally closed one of its 8 military bases in Panama, part of a commitment to remove all troops and hand over all U.S. installations before the end of the century. Under treaty signed by President Jimmy Carter in 1977, the United States agreed to close all of its bases before transferring the Panama Canal, one of the world's most famous and strategic waterways, which links the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. Among the casualties of the move is the Pentagon's Southern Command, which will now transfer to Miami, Florida. Joining us right now from Berkeley, California, is John Lindsay Poland. He's head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force on Latin America, has done a great deal of work on Panama over the last few years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Good morning, Amy.
Why don't you tell us about what the significance is of the moving of the U.S. Southern Command to Miami from Panama?
Well, we should note, first of all, that what's moved is the headquarters of the Southern Command. The U.S. military bases in Panama are a number of different installations, and the headquarters is the coordinating body for all U.S. military relations with Latin America. So it has a long history of coordinating interventions in El Salvador and Nicaragua, and further back in Mexico during the revolution there, against Sandino in Nicaragua in the 1920s, and 20 different invasions of Panama, interventions in Panama. But what's moved to Miami is about 800 people. There are still 4,400 troops left in Panama. And the United States and Panama are right now at this very moment negotiating whether to keep a couple thousand of those troops in Panama under the guise of a counter-drug center. So that the move of the headquarters to Miami may have some symbolic value, but it may not affect the whole sovereignty issue for Panama of having the U.S. military right there on the banks of the canal.
And what will the eventual turnover, the complete turnover of the Canal Zone area to Panama, how is that being effectuated, and what's going to be the impact economically on Panama, and also politically in terms of United States control of the canal?
Mm-hmm. Well, the military bases were about 12 different bases, which are gradually being closed up until through 1999. And they lie right in the heart of Panama's economic and population centers. About 3/4 of the economic activity, about 2/3 of the population live along the banks of the canal. And so those bases have always distorted Panama's economic development. Panama City, for example, as it has grown, like most Latin American cities, has grown in the shape of a sausage rather than organically, because it hasn't been able to grow into these military base areas. So many Panamanians are hoping that the bases will be able to be used for social uses and for the benefit of the national economy. Now, politically, the United States is pressuring Panama to keep some military there, so it's uncertain whether all of the bases will be returned. What they want to use them for, purportedly, is a counter-drug center. And in Panama, this is being sold as a civilian center. That is, it would be run by civilians, and it would not be a military base, according to President Pérez Valladares. Most Panamanians don't believe that, and there is some conflict, apparently, in negotiations now about exactly whether it will have extraterritoriality, that is, whether the military troops there will have rights beyond what other foreign nationals have in Panama, which for Panamanians is the line between a military base and Panama. In any case, the role of the military troops there is not only national, it also is for the whole region, because the air base, Howard Air Base, is used for surveillance of unauthorized aircraft and maritime traffic throughout the whole region. And that's really what they'd like to keep as an air base there, in order to be able to go down to southern Peru and Colombia and Bolivia, as well as the Caribbean, and as well as train troops, which is also part of the proposal for Howard Air Base.
John Lindsay Poland, a Fellowship of Reconciliation in Berkeley. We've just been joined by Marco Gandasaki, who is director of the Center for Latin American Studies in Panama City. Now, he hasn't heard all of what you said, but Marco, I wanted to ask you what it was like this week as the headquarters of the U.S. Southern Command made their exit, the reaction of the people.
Well, thank you very much, in the first place, for this interview. In Panama, people have seen the exit of the Southern Command headquarters from Panama to Miami very positively. It seems that things are marching in the correct direction of a complete evacuation of military troops, U.S. military troops from Panama by the year 2000. However, there is a dark cloud in the horizon. Because of the negotiations that are presently taking place between Panama and the United States to have a continuation of a military presence, U.S. military presence in Panama after the year 2000, although the Panama Canal treaties and the Panamanian Constitution prohibit any sort of foreign military presence in Panama. That includes, of course, U.S. military presence. So there is this conflict that has already appeared in the horizon, and that has most Panamanians very, very worried about our future and our relations with the United States.
Mr. Gandasaki, most of our listeners are not aware of the tremendous influence and control that the United States has had on the Panamanian national life. Dating back to the building of the Panama Railroad in the 1850s, the first major United States investment abroad, and then, of course, through the creation of Panama, through the support of a rebellion against Colombia by Teddy Roosevelt, and the construction of the canal. Could you tell us, in terms of how the general population is viewing, at the same time the United States brought a tremendous amount of economic income into the country through the building of the canal. Is there a certain ambivalence, or is there on the part of the people in terms of the the evacuation of this American presence?
Well, in the first place, I think we have to acknowledge the enormous influence that the United States, economic influence that the United States has had on Panama since this whole century, especially since the construction of the Panama Canal between 1904 and 1914. During these 10 years, Panama was transformed physically, although we have to take into account that Panama historically, since the Spanish colonization, has been a major stepping stone for world trade. So in that sense, Panamanians took it in stride, U.S. influence. During this century, Panama has gone through several upheavals, social upheavals, and so things have changed, I'd say, radically. A very strong nationalist movement arose in the mid-20th century after the Second World War that insisted that the U.S. military presence must end. And overall, not only the U.S. military presence, but the fact that in Panama, we had a U.S. colony, the so-called Panama Canal Zone, that split the country in half and surrounded the Panama Canal. This colonial presence was resented very much by Panamanian people. This colonial presence came to an end due to these Panama Canal treaties in 1979, just 20 years ago. Precisely October 1st of 1979, 20 years ago yesterday. And since then, we've been expecting we've been living through a transition by which the United States has to evacuate all the military bases it had in Panama by the year 2000. And the other third very important aspect of this transition period is the fact that in the last day of the century, 31st of December of 1999, the U.S. will be transferring the Panama Canal over to Panamanian administration. So all these aspects are very important for Panamanian life and on a political level dominate our present situation.
Just for listeners who aren't aware of exactly what the Panama Canal Zone is, you know, built in 1914, in exchange for an annual fee, Panama gave the Americans the canal and a 10-mile-wide strip of land running along it. The Americans built 10 military bases and civilian colonies, enforcing their own laws on what they said was U.S. soil. Which leads me to my next question, Marcos, which has to do with why the Panamanians dislike the U.S. so much. And perhaps it also goes to what happened in the late 1980s, which was the U.S. invasion of Panama. Juan, you were also there covering it, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And I think most listeners, again, don't understand that during that period of the existence of the Canal Zone, the United States maintained a virtual apartheid system between the white Americans who were part of the Canal administration and the military, and the largely West Indian immigrant laborers who had originally built the canal and stayed. And you in essence, had a total segregated white-black, the gold payrolls and silver payrolls, separate payrolls for the blacks and whites within the canal, while Panamanians, whose country it was, were almost excluded from all the canal life, largely except for small groups of Indians that were involved in some of the base maintenance. But one of the things that's occurred to me, and I'd like to ask Mr. Gandasecki about this also, and John Lindsay Poland, is now that the Panamanian government is beginning to make new contracts for economic concessions for the ports at each end of the canal. There are other companies that are coming into play other than American companies that are being granted concessions. Is this creating any kind of conflict with the American business community in the letting of these contracts, and have there been any problems involved with them?
Well, first of all, I would like to just very shortly answer the first question in what concerns resentment towards the United States on the part of Panamanians. Actually, Panamanians feel very friendly towards U.S. people of the United States, and they've shown this throughout the century, even last century. What Panamanians resent is not the United States, but U.S. government policy that in one way or another goes against Panamanian interests. Most of the time we cannot discuss these problems. There's no dialogue with the United States. There's no negotiations. The U.S. imposes its will on on Panama. When we have the opportunity to negotiate, we're always negotiating, of course, from the shorter end of the stick, because we're a very small country, and the United States is the largest country in the world, most powerful country in the world. But in that sense, I do want to make the distinction between resentment towards policies of the U.S. Mm-hmm. government, but we do feel friendship towards the people of the United States, and I think I'm almost sure that the feeling is mutual. The American people, the people of the United States, have a strong feeling of friendship towards Panamanians. Concerning
Marco, we have to break quickly, and then we're going to come back just for a minute, wrap up from you and John Lindsay Poland, and then on to the fact that this is Breast Cancer Awareness Month in the United States. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're talking about the U.S. Southern Command leaving Panama, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, getting final comments from Marco Gandasaki, who is director of the Center for Latin American Studies in Panama, and John Lindsay Poland with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, speaking to us from Berkeley. Marco, just a quick answer to that second question.
Sure. Well, at present, the Panamanian government has decided that it has to put on sale concession all the territories that once were part of the Panama Canal Zone. This has also been questioned by many groups here in Panama, because we feel that a more careful planning process has to take place in order for this the use of these lands be more consistent with national development and the welfare of the Panamanian people. The Panamanian government, in that sense, has decided to negotiate with private enterprises from all over the world, China, Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong, France, Italy, the U.S., all the lands and all the infrastructure that exists. The only thing that is being left out and is going to continue under a solid public administration is the Panama Canal itself. And that worries a lot of people also, because there is no planning process, no serious planning process taking place. And we feel that it's important that we put our aims, our objectives clearly on the board, so that everybody understands what we're looking for and how we can reach those goals.
We're going to wrap up with John Lindsay Poland. What are you doing in this country, John, to make people aware of what's happening in Panama and organizing around the end of the Panama Canal and the U.S. Southern Command?
Well, we're organizing
in U.S. hands.
We're organizing to let the Clinton administration know that we think the canal treaties should be implemented and all the troops should be brought home. The negotiations are expected to be concluded in November, and so we're urging people to contact the State Department and not have the U.S. policy in Panama be run by Senator Jesse Helms. If people would like more information, they can get to our webpage, which is at www.nonviolence.org/FOR/Panama. And there's more information there on the bases and on the Southern Command.
Well, John Lindsay Poland, thank you very much for coming into Pacifica Station KPFA studios in Berkeley. John Lindsay Poland, head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation's Task Force on Latin America. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we switch gears completely and talk about this October, we just entered yesterday. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
We are the generation who was born and came of adult age during the most toxic and environmentally unregulated decade ever known, whose baby food was contaminated with traces of DDT, PCBs, and DES. Our neighborhoods were sprayed with pesticides and filled with toxic waste. Most of these chemicals did not even exist before World War II. We are the generation whose early idealism opened the original generation gap. We didn't know that this gap would come to mean premature and early death in our 30s, 40s, and 50s. We didn't know that the in generation was destined to become the cancer generation. We didn't know that so many of our mothers would bury us.
And that is an excerpt of Rachel's Daughters, Searching for the Causes of Breast Cancer. It's an HBO documentary that chronicles the lives of eight breast cancer survivors as they investigate the possible causes of and treatments for breast cancer. The breast cancer epidemic will claim an estimated 500,000 lives this decade. But what is causing the epidemic? That is the question. One of the co-producers of the documentary called Rachel's Daughters is Nancy Evans. She, too, is a breast cancer survivor and joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Irving Saraf is with us as well. He is co-director and co-producer of Rachel's Daughter. And he got interested in this because his 39-year-old daughter was diagnosed with breast cancer. Let's begin with Nancy Evans. I watched this documentary last night, Nancy. It's a very powerful documentary. Tell us about the unusual forums that you set up in this documentary.
Well, the forums that we arranged were interviews with some of the top scientists in the country who are doing research to try to find the cause or causes of breast cancer. And the interviewers were women who had never interviewed before, women living with breast cancer. And we have a total of 21 scientists from places like the National Cancer Institute, from Harvard, from Tufts University, from Duke University, from Stanford, from University of California, Berkeley, really top-flight people.
I was most interested in the emphasis on the environment. It's not something we hear a lot about when we talk about breast cancer. There's much more emphasis, it seems, in the scientific community on genes. Irving Saraf, can you talk about this decision to go with issues like nutrition and the environment?
Well, we selected the various subject areas that are being researched. And the environment has been neglected. Genes, the subject of discovery of damaged genes, is very kind of sexy for newspapers because it makes good headlines. We have one of the people who actually was involved in the cloning of the first so-called breast cancer gene, Dr. Futrell, in our film, says this is just a very small step in the understanding of the mechanism of breast cancer.
I thought it was interesting that the New York Times panned Rachel's Daughters yesterday in their review of it, saying that all this, you know, discussion of issues like environment is, you know, it's a lot of speculation.
Now, what are the credentials of the woman who wrote it? We have two members of the Academy of Sciences, four people from National Cancer Institute, a person who conducts the biggest prospective study in the world, the nurse's study at Harvard University, and here comes some woman whose scientific credentials are dubious, and she debunks them all. So I said enough.
I think she's a writer with an agenda. She's done this to other scientists who have written about the connections between environmental contamination and health. And so we are not the first to be attacked by this particular reporter.
The reporter is Gina Collada, and the headline is Seeking Something to Blame When Breast Cancer Strikes.
Right.
In terms of the various experts that you interview in the film, does there emerge any kind of consensus in terms of what kind of potential environmental causes might seem to dominate over others?
Well, from my standpoint, radiation is a clearly identifiable culprit, and it's probably the only one that we can pinpoint, because there are many other factors that probably work together. Occupational exposures, pesticides, for example, that you might use at home, hormones, both oral contraceptives and hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women. It's very difficult to establish which one or ones of those things might cause breast cancer, and probably they all have some kind of synergistic effect. That is, the sum of all of them is the effects are greater than the chemicals or factors individually.
From my point of view, it's really the combination, because a lot of things attack our immune system and our DNA structure. That's my understanding from all the scientists. And we have repair mechanisms. But when enough factors overwhelm our repair mechanism, our system yields and develops disease.
We're talking to Nancy Evans and Irving Saroff. They're co-producers of the documentary Rachel's Daughters, Searching for the Causes of Breast Cancer. It aired on HBO last night and will continue to air throughout the month of October. It's a powerful film, and it really is the engine of the film are a number of breast cancer survivors, including Nancy Evans, who go to various scientists and pose questions to them, leading scientists in the field of breast cancer. I was very struck, Nancy, by an interview done with one of the scientists who said that all of their work seemed to have become contaminated, and they couldn't figure out why it got contaminated until they realized the plastic they were using was contaminating and causing an estrogen-like substance to be introduced. And this person said she actually doesn't eat things that have been in plastic for a long period of time.
Yes, that was Anna Soto from Tufts University, and she's not the only scientist to have done studies related to chemicals that can leach from plastic. One of the things she says is not to microwave food in plastic, because the heat may release chemicals. And since there are many different formulations of plastics, we're not saying that all plastic does this, but because we don't know what's in various plastics, the safer thing is to microwave in glass or in ceramics. And generally, the softer the plastic, the more pliable, the more likely it is to contain polyvinyl chloride, which is a very dangerous chemical.
There's also a whole discussion in the documentary with an African-American scientist and the African-American women breast cancer survivors who go to ask questions about the lack of research done on African-American women.
Yes,
that's very true, and it's too bad, because breast cancer is much more deadly in that particular community, and we don't know whether it's the quality of care, whether it's late diagnosis, or whether, in fact, they may have very different kinds of tumors. So that's an area where more research is definitely needed.
There's been a lot of debate in recent years about the impact of electromagnetic fields, and your film also touches on electromagnetic fields as possible sources of breast cancer. Could you talk a little bit about that?
As promoters, Dr. Richard Stevens, who is one of the foremost EMF researchers in the world, and was very much in contact with the Swedish and Finnish researchers in Europe, says that he agrees that EMF cannot damage the DNA, so it's not an initiator. But the thing is that once the damage is done, it can be repaired unless something hampers the repair. And that's what hormones are accused of doing. And he says that EMF may, that there is indication that it may interfere with hormonal balance. And in that case, it would be a promoter. A tumor needs a promotion to be able to grow. And that's where the research is focused on. Nancy, if you want to elaborate on that.
Right. These studies that Dr. Stevens and others have done indicate that EMFs can definitely interfere with the function of the pineal gland, which is a gland that secretes melatonin. For example, if you put breast cancer cells in a laboratory dish and you add melatonin to the dish, the cells stop growing. But if you put that same dish in an electromagnetic field, the cells start to grow again. Now, this is pretty provocative, even though cells in a dish don't necessarily behave the way cells in the body do. But all of these exposures that we're talking about, the pesticides, the occupational chemicals, the plastics, the EMFs, all of these are avoidable exposures to some degree. And so we can't wait for proof to take some prudent actions. And this is what the film is really about, to look at things that we can do something about. You can't go back and redo your genes, but you can change the things that you expose yourself to, at least to a degree.
Nancy, yeah. Evans.
Yeah, I just want to add something very important that Dr. Stephen cautions. That doesn't mean that popping melatonin pills is going to reduce your risk
right.
of breast cancer. Be very careful about that.
We just have a minute to go, and I wanted to comment just on the end of the documentary where you have women in black who cover a hillside symbolizing the women who have died of breast cancer in this country. In the documentary, one of the breast cancer survivors had been a survivor, died as you were doing the documentary. Nancy Evans, how long have you been free of cancer?
As far as I know, I've been free of cancer almost 7 years, which is very reassuring.
And as you finished up this documentary, interviewing scientists, working with many women from all different ethnic groups, questioning the experts, what did you come away with?
I came away with the feeling that there are things we can do to reduce our risk, but that we don't have any sure answers, and that what we need more than anything else is awareness by the public that we need to make policy changes that will reduce exposures for everyone.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Irving Saraf and Nancy Evans, co-producers of Rachel's Daughters, Searching for the Causes of Breast Cancer. And you can see this film, it will air a number of times on HBO throughout this month of October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Kevin Cartwright engineered from Berkeley. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Tune in tomorrow when we speak with Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders and also hear from the Promise Keepers and an analysis of the march that they will be having in Washington on Saturday.